Blog Talk Radio.
And we're back for part two of Educating Language Minority Children. And this was the part that you needed to hear that we were going to show on tomorrow, but we decided to go ahead and show it this evening and give you that complete compository. And I'll be giving you information from Eric Digest. And most of you teachers should know about Eric's Digest. This digest was created by Eric, the Educational Resource Information Center. For more information about Eric, you can contact to access Eric at 1-800-LET-ERIC. And Eric has been very, very accommodating for teachers for many, many years now. And why can't all Americans just speak standard English, one might ask? This plaintive question reflects the distress many citizens feel about linguistic diversity in the schools. Now, I'm going to be giving you information, and the author is Barbara T. Bowman. And this is the identifier is also up under Eric. And educating language minority children is our topic for this evening. And we're going to try to give you that information because for most minorities, since our heading was in that topic, we wanted to cover that information by Barbara. And I'd like to quote to you what she has written here. Why can't all Americans just speak standard English? This plaintiff question reflects the distress that many citizens feel about the linguistic diversity in the schools. In many schools, districts, language of Central and Southern American, African, Asian mixed with American dialect creates a classroom in which communication is difficult, they think. Across America, children are not learning essential lessons in school in the next decade or two, she writes. The problem will become even more serious. Language minority children will have more serious problems, she feels, because the majority in public schools seriously restraining the capacity of those. In a nation increasingly composed of people who are speaking different languages and dialects, the old notion of melting them together through the use of common language is once again attractive, requiring all children to speak the same language at a high level of proficiency would make the task of educating them a good deal easier. Unfortunately, what's seeming quite good in theory is difficult to put into practice, she writes. In this instance, the interruption of culture, language, and the children's development may make a common language difficult to obtain. Now, let's just break that down. In other words, they want you to have a bastardized English and bring everything together up under one roof and speak one language. Well, with people coming from all over the world, you'll find that it is much difficult for various different foreigners to speak the one language. And she goes on to write in that quote, culture, language, and development. Difference in the ways groups think and act are more than a matter of using different words or performing different actions for the same purpose, she says. And I quote, difference in culture are more sustainable than whether members of a community eat white bread, common pons, or tortillas. And the behavior of people vary in the belief, values, and assumptions that underlies believers' difference as well. Cultural influence, both behavior and the psychological process on which it rests. Culture, and I quote, she says, forms a prism through which members of a group sees the world and create shaded meaning. And a group's culture is reflected by the group's language. Now, let me break that down. What do we mean by groups? Are we talking about tribes? Even within the African tribes, there is a unique behavior and customs and tradition. And that is why you have tribal wars against all of the tribes that try to come together. Because oftentimes they have different values and they practice different values, and it causes problems amongst the group. Now, just as you know, you have your individual way of thinking, and you have your tribal way of thinking, where you have to go to the tribe to make a decision. And she writes, and I quote, child development follows a pattern similar to that of culture. And she wants us to believe that the pattern that is presents itself for culture also presents itself for child development. She writes, I quote, major structural changes in children, such as language learning, arise from the interaction of biology and experience, such as changes are remarkably similar to in kind and sequence among cultural groups. But the knowledge and skills, she adds, the culture, the learning the child acquires at various age that depends on the child's family and community. And I quote, and she says, learning a primary language is a developmental milestone. However, which language a child learns and the use to which that language is put are determined by the culture as the ideas from a child's social world are brought to bear through the guidance of older members of the community. Now, that's one thing we have to look at. Our elders in the community, are they valued? Are they used as resources? And do they pass the baton so we can actively put them into the scheme of things so that when we are in our circle, we can properly give them their trumps by asking permission to speak, by allowing them to lead our meetings and giving them honor and respect. Some groups do not value elders in their groups. As a matter of fact, there have been stories of elders put on the outside of the caves, left there to die. And after they've died, they've actually dried them out and documented that some of the cultural groups have become cannibals and eaten their own mothers and fathers and grandmothers. So that would tell you the value that they have of the elders. But in the Native American indigenous people, you'll find that the elders are treated very kindly and with respect. And the same thing used to hold true for the African Americans. We held our elders in high esteem. We are changing, of course, and we need to get back on track to ask for permission from our elders to speak and to say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and to also be able to attribute the training that we receive from our elders. And when someone asks who has initiated you, we should be able to say that our elders have initiated us and passed on the knowledge that we have. However, in a classroom setting, you must have to look at things a little differently. You cannot continue to think a classroom setting would be more like a home or family. It wouldn't. And I quote, she says, the classroom, this course, presents children with the challenge of learning new rules for communication. The use of formal language, teachers' control of verbal exchange questions and answers formats, and references to increasingly abstract ideas characterized by the classroom environment. To the extent that these new rules overlap with those that children have already learned, classroom communication is made easier, but children whose past experience or language is not congruent with the new rules will have to learn ways to make meaning before they can use language to learn in the classroom. Now, that's what I want to point out, end of quote. Communication must be now and in the present. And the now means be able to express what you mean and mean what you say and get the understanding now. Not in some far off distance when you revisit a subject, but you must get that clarification and understanding of what you're trying to convey in that conversation immediately. It might take a while, but that's why it's important for teachers to be up on their traditions and customs and understanding other cultures without being lost in the conversation, because they have not sensitized themselves to the various different customs and traditions. For example, when African American children come into the classroom and they're speaking Ebonics, and they're not communicating at the level of the majority of the people in the class, it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't know words. It means that their words may not be applicable to the conversation. They may still know words. As a matter of fact, they may know a lot of words, but you must intrigue them to look at similarities of words that mean the same but are spelled and sound differently. And then vice versa, the words that sound the same but have different meanings. So just as African Americans recreate their Ebonics and the shortened words, the African American community makes sure that there are very few words to say. They are not on speaking loquacious and speaking many words. The fewer the words, the better. However, when you go in a society like the Euro society, they're more loquacious, speaking many words and having many words that they can retire, all in lieu of those new words. So you have a play on words, and that's why when this chatting came out, African Americans took to it like a fish in water, because they didn't have to spell out the whole word, and they could abbreviate, and they can shorten words. And that's the whole scheme for African America. The fewer, less is better. And we teach that in math, that less is better. But yet we go on talking about using all these elaborate words, putting too many words in a sentence when you can just use the one, and then having this excess overload of words. That is not a part of the custom for the African. That's why they nickname everything with a shorter version. Now, Caucasian also constantly are changing names. As you can see in Africa, they went to Africa and they reworded words such as Africa was not the name of Africa. It was called Octavian Land. However, the Eurocentric people decided to call it Africa. So they have actually changed the names of the words, not for the sake of it being shorter, but just for the sake of having control over these words that they have named. It's just like having animals in their garden that they have given names to, and those animals give homage to them, sort of like a mother instinct of some kind. But it's very valuable to know that we put out the information that we're part Egyptian. Believe it or not, Egyptians were loquacious in their writing. They wrote on everything, on the walls and the temples, and they displayed and left their mark. And so are African Americans, even though they shorten their words when they talk, and we think they come to school with far less words, probably to the tune of 5,000 less words. Now, that's a whole lot of words that you're minusing. But for you to see young people demonstrate the art of spoken word or the art of poetry, they use as many words to express themselves as possible. And they don't retire any words. They use them over and over again. So in their mind, they are recreating words, and they have their very own private dictionary where slang counts and it can be used, and they recreate words and introduce brand new words that some of us that are non-Melanite people have never heard before. And we view that as being clever and quite artistic when we hear these words that are being changed in their content and in their meaning. Like cold, that's cold. And it doesn't mean that there's a wind blowing in and you're freezing and shivering. That means that's down, that's low down, that's cool, that's tough. Can you dig it? See, we've got to put ourselves in a place of the beatnik. And we remember, I'm sure, Caucasian, you remember the beatnik because you brought the beatnik's character out. And everything that he would say would be short and sweet and to the point. That's cool, down, tough. They never gave a full sentence because time was of the essence and communication was very vague during that particular era of time, because the less you said, the quicker you can move about and be about your way. So don't fall upon the African child for using these tactics to eliminate those words. That does not mean that the African-American child has fewer words. That means that he elects to only give you so many words because of the sake of time. He is texting. His time is valuable. So he's a stenographer, and he is getting all of these fragmented words in, which mean something, which are Ebonics, and it doesn't have to be Orthodox language as long as it is a regularized code and is used throughout the community where they can communicate with it. It is a language. I repeat, teachers, you of Caucasian descent, you must understand this, because so many of our children are failing because their papers were marked up with red marks because teachers have told them this isn't a word. This is not a recognized word. In their regularized code, they can create words and bring them to the dictionary. Just as you can retire words, they can add words to their own black dictionary. And I do mean that literally, the black law dictionary. They can create one of their own. I want to see children write fluently with a flow and a change of information without that being halted because of a misspelled word or because of the fact that it may be a recreated word. We want the flow of English to convey that one sentence, no matter how many mechanical errors there may be. We can go back and fix the mechanical errors. That's why we have computers now with software that's created to repair all those mechanical errors. Once you get your flow going, I don't want anything to disrupt it. With anybody looking over your shoulders, red marking your paper up, influencing you to stop writing, and then you sit there with a blank page because you're so afraid of what others will think in critiquing your work. Well, teachers, I have good news for you. You don't want to critique the work on the first draft. You want them to just write and write and write and write and build the volume. In getting the volume, you can always go back, reread the information, make anecdotal notes, pull down your editing tool where you use your mechanical editing tool to correct the errors that are mechanically correctable. Some words are slang words. You do not have to take them out of this context, like ain't, because when you're using short stories or poetry or spoken word, you use slang, and it's perfectly okay. You do not have to speak Orthodox English or the King's English. At that point, you're appealing to an audience that comes from a variety of continents and from a variety of place and time and space. So just like Nina Simone went on stage and she began to communicate with her audience by asking them, can you dig it? Can you dig it? Is everything copacetic? Now, if you can travel with me in a time block, and if you're honest, you'll see that when you're out in the corridor amongst those who are in the know, you want to come across as being in the know too. You don't want to use a lot of fragmented sentences. You want to speak directly to the occasion. So it's very vital that you should understand this, else you will stop a lot of good writers from going on to be the best. I know this because I, for one, had to learn that it was very important for me to keep my flow going. Don't worry about the spelling of that word. Create the spelling if you need to. Just keep the flow going. And as you read that document or text back to your teacher, it will have a continuity, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it won't be void of the substance of the middle. You have to give voice to that paper. You have to give voice to the audience you're speaking to, whether it be in the present tense or the second tense. It's very vital that you don't sit there with a blank sheet of paper because your flow has been dried up or halted because someone intervened to tell you about a correction of a mechanical error. So what if you didn't put a period there? You can go back and tell the system, look for all errors that I may have occurred. There is software that you can work with now that works with you throughout the whole document and finds all the errors. And if you're using something like Dragon Nationally Speaking, you can speak and enunciate into your software on the computer, and it will take down and record your message. You will have to go back and fill in the errors and the areas that they have not included. You will have to punctuate and mechanically make corrections. The main thing is that your point is gotten across. Communication is where one person listens and the other one talks, and your message is gotten across. Some people have this thing so wrong that when they call you, and if they were the ones that had a question, they will give you a stream of information and connecting them to so many different things that you lose the message. You only need to have one thought when you bring about a paragraph. What is that beginning? And did you repeat that beginning at the end to reiterate to your listening audience that you are sending and conveying a message? Some people give so much information, you lose the message in the context. That's what you don't want to stop children from doing. Now, I have seen a lot of children go into the I step to get ready to write their paragraph. They know their subject. They have read their subject and clearly have comprehended and understand what went on. But when it comes to them sitting down, writing a paragraph to describe the best part or the plot, they lose the continuity. It just goes right out of their head. And they sit there with this blank look on their face doing the test when they don't have the time to do that. We've got to teach our children to go on and think fluently and use a pencil with the eraser on it and go back and make the corrections as they go. But get that thought out. Get that beginning, middle, and end. And don't always say in conclusion of, we sound like boilerplate robots. And we must stop teaching our children that. We must teach them to have a voice in what they're saying, and a first person, second person, and determine whose position are they telling the story in. It's very vital that in order to become good writers, we write about subjects that we are fond of. And those subjects that you are fond of and that you have interest in, you tend to have a lot more to write about. But when you take on a subject matter that you know totally nothing about, that's a research paper. You then have to go and gather your hypothesis and gather your data and make a hypothesis and in conclusion of your data based on what you collect. You make a collective decision that this is what you found in your data. So as we see young people write, now that the computers are here and they have to get 5 or 6 sources of their writing, that's a good thing because the computer provides all that. But feelings is something that you draw from the inside. And from your gut feeling is something that you write about. From your creative side is where I can teach you to start writing. When you go into a trance and you go sublimely under the water and away from the subconscious mind and then begin to allow your right side of your brain to emerge and begin to give you information to write. At that point, while you're dazing off, neither conscious or unconscious, but in a subliminal state, that is the time that you take your notes. That is also the time that you begin to write. And from your conscious mind, you can draw all those positive things to write about, even subjects you don't know anything about. You know how I know? Because I once decided to do a 21-day meditation on a regular basis and to write during that meditation, and I was able to create a 36-page collection of poems, and I wrote about topics that I had no knowledge of, and I wrote about topics that I was just being introduced to. And I gave credence to those topics as if I had depths of knowledge when, in fact, I only had a breadth of knowledge. Now, I'm saying all that to say to some of you stakeholders and some of you adjuncts, professors, and instructors, you have to know your subject. You have to know a little bit about the culture. And you don't necessarily have to travel around the world, but you have to read about those cultures. Take interest in those cultures. And don't just say, I'm not interested, and then you go in to judge or critique an African-American child. You know nothing about their culture, and they're not. They may not be a ghetto child. They may have lived in a middle-class family. You just assume they came from the ghetto. And when they start articulating about the things that they have in their lives and their experiences, then you're cut off. You begin to say, this couldn't have happened. This child came from the depths of the bottom of the ghetto. How is this possible that this child has lived a lifestyle like this? That's exactly what happened when a slave began to write who had no experiences about the time and air, but yet her instructors who read her work began to accuse her of plagiarizing her work, stating that it could not possibly be her life because they knew she was a slave and she couldn't have experienced those lifetime experiences. Let me explain to you. Writing is in the subliminal subconscious mind. You are traveling. You are taking flight. You are not in your present space and time, nor in your present mind. You can take off and explore places that are beyond this earth or planet, and no one has the right to steal those experiences from you. If the depths of your psychology has taken you to a place that's unbeknown to all who may be involved, and even to yourself, because remember, this is a journey that your subconscious mind allows you to take the pressure off the conscious mind and go to the depths of the subconscious, and that is where you leave your burdens and take on the lightness of less pressure. So when the mind is less pressure, it can think and have more creative experiences. Now, let's not take those creative experiences away from our African-American children just because they live at the bottom of the hill and in the depths of the ghetto does not mean that they don't have experiences like a king or queen. We must remember that in their cosmic records, which holds all the deposits of where their ancestors have been, they are able to tap into that cosmic record and draw from it. It's the sum total of where their ancestors came and all the experiences they had. So that is made available to that African-American child just for the asking. But they must go to the depths of their soul while meditating in a subconscious, subliminal mind underneath the water. That is how you teach deep experiences in writing. Once I learned that I could write any poem at any time, putting myself in a trance to be able to recall experiences that I knew from a place and a time that wasn't here and wasn't now. But exploring an out-of-body experience is what we should teach our subjects to do, and to teach them to be creative as they can be in creating the characters, the background, itinerary for the story, and beginning to create from a point that we might not ever be able to experience, but thanks be to God that their mind is strong enough to hold the energy frequency long enough to write about it. Because you're dreaming, you must remember that. And some of us, when we come up out of this dream, we forget everything we've actually learned in that dream. Then there are those who can hold on to those memories and write about them. We do not have the right to take them away, nor to tell their parents that that child will never be suited for anything, and that do not waste your time sending them to college, because we don't know that. We don't know what was in the mind of the beholder who created that child. There's destiny in every child, and I want you to know that. If you're training African-American children and you mistreat them and take away the destiny that they hold, you will be punished. You will be sought out and punished. And there are many cruel teachers who have taken away the desire of children to learn, Some children refuse to learn up under their auspice because they have crushed that child to the ground. But God says his creation will never be crushed to the ground. And you must understand, you must prepare yourself for your subject, because don't be surprised that most of these children are more clever and smarter and wiser than we ever would be, because they take more chances and we are set in our ways. Now, I'm saying all that to say that we must be good teachers when it comes to being patient with our subjects and giving them the benefit of doubt. But if you do not use these skills to adduce knowledge, it's nothing you can teach a child about writing, math, science, social study. It's already in them. African Americans come here equipped with the Akashic records of their ancestors, and that is more than any of us teachers could ever give a child. They are already equipped to tap into that Akashic records and draw from that melanin. Within that melanin, there is also a Akashic record that will allow them to be able to use their skin like a brain, because the skin with the melanin in it functions just like a brain, like a frontal lobe, temporal lobe, occipital lobe. It draws that information because the ancestors have left it there. That is the difference of an African-American child, is that their ancestors are speaking to them at all times and carrying them through things. And they are believers because their mom have already put it in them to listen to the spirit, and your first mind is your right mind. So therein lies something different for the African-American, you say. Yes, it is not the same as a Caucasian child would have, because they wouldn't have that early experience with spirit, whereas most children from birth, they learn to trust, and they have that first experience with spirit and learning to listen for the spirit and be guided by the spirit. That is the difference. Now, let me go on. Classroom discourse presents children with the challenge of learning new rules or communication, the use of formal language, teachers' control of verbal exchange, questions and answer formats, and references to increasingly abstract ideas, those that children have already learned. Classroom communication is made easier, but children whose past experiences with language is not congruent with the new rule will have to learn ways to make meaning before they can use the language to learn in the classroom, not so. They do not have to make any congruent exchanges. I'm telling you now that children that are engrossed and that are kinesthetic learners only need to be in the surroundings. Just touching a very subject matter with information can allow that person's hand to act like a brain, to gather that knowledge and factual information to draw conclusions. That is the difference of African-American children. Now, if you read Dr. Lyola Africa, he will clearly explain to you the makeup of an African child is different from any other race of children. And I know this because when I did my research, I discovered this through Dr. Ames, who was a Caucasian doctor who specialized in researching children from birth that were not in the Western world and their development of speech and language, and saw that they were far more advanced than any Westerners' children in their cooing, speaking their first words, having conversation, in their ability to smile, in their ability to have dialogue, and in their ability to be fluent, to stand, to walk and to crawl, and to be potty trained. And when Dr. Ames found this out, she began to disseminate this information about African children. What happened to our African American children? Did we dumb down the curriculum or something? Because these children, from the age of birth until the rightful age of puberty, have an extra release of ruined minerals in their brain, along with another mineral that will allow them to supercharge and survey the area, pick up the knowledge with their melanin, be able to use eye-hand coordination, decipher a thing, figure it out, put it back together. Now, here's an example. It was a test done in Africa where a doctor and a group of his team members went to Africa and dropped off a box. And wouldn't you know it, in that box was a laptop computer. And that computer was left there to see if those African children would use discovery rules to figure out how it worked. In less than a week's time, the children began to open the box and take the box apart and plug up the hardware and turn on the computer. And from turning on the computer, they were able to get to the software department. And this is all before ever any instruction. They were able to get to the software and began to manipulate the computer with different software and programs. And when the gentleman came back, the doctor, he discovered that the children had already gotten into the system and had began to matriculate to the modules and lessons. They taught themselves, in other words, right? Yes, they did. Because they have mother wits, because they have Kostic records. They're not working alone in this thing. So how can you tell me so many African-American children are failing when their ancestors are traveling with them, when their ancestors are functioning them on and speaking to them and revealing things to them? They're elders. They have the following of the elders to assist and aid them. So mothers, you've got to start teaching your children about ancestors and about the fact that spirit doesn't let anything slip upon you, and it recalls all things. It is like a computer itself. How do I know? Because I went through school on predicated on those particular concepts. Call on the spirit, Eli. He will pick you up. He will make you strong, and he will reveal all things to you that's unknown. I relied heavily on the spirit. Most of your orphanage children rely heavily on the spirit because they feel that there's something in the atmosphere that is coming to assist them and aid them. For to be without a mother or father means the spirit will always be surrounding you with your mother and father, watching over you to protect you, to aid you. So it's very vital that we should take our children from this old perspective of church to spirit and make the child walk by sight, walk by spirit and not by sight. Because everything that child do, if they rest, rule, and abide under the concept of spirit, they know that what spirit done from them before, he will do it again, or she will do it again. But it's very vital that we get an understanding that African Americans are spiritual people. Very spiritual. Because they will begin to have conversations with you about where they came from and how God released them to come here to aid and assist their family. They've had an out-of-body experience already. And they know that this is a different world for them. So why are we teaching these old, died-out curriculums? Why are we asking the child, where did they come from? And where were they before they came here? And can they take us there? It's very important that you understand that there are some children, like I talked about, the child prodigy child, that have information that you will never have. And they already have mastered certain subjects. You are not teaching them anything. The knowledge has been planted within them. You are just drawing in knowledge out of them, adducing the knowledge. You cannot teach a child anything. You can only adduce the knowledge that's already been placed there. We all have the essence of God placed within us. You are obligated to stir up the gift, to get the gift going, get a fire going. Like Dr. John Henry Clark says, I get up to make the fire. That what you're looking for, that spark is already on the inside of that individual child. You must light enough flames to get the fire going to set up the combustion so the child is fired up. Once you see the child fired up with the frequency high in the room, that frequency passes throughout the atmosphere of that room, bouncing off of different children and them getting the light bulb message. And that's the kind of learning you want to go on when it comes to writing. Now, let me go on. Classroom discourse is what we just talked about. I want to go on and quote her, and as she say, when teachers and students come from different cultures or use different languages or dialect, teachers may be unaware of variations between their understanding of a context and their students. Now, if you're unaware, teachers, it's okay to say, I don't know. Don't pretend that you know and look over the child's statement when he's telling you what the options are. Trust him until you can prove him wrong. But you must give homage to that child and the context of the students between their expectation for behavior and the child's inclination. When children and adults do not share common experiences and beliefs, guess what? It causes hostile feelings in the classroom. Let's find out. And I quote, adults are less able to help children encode their thoughts in language. If a child likes you and believes in you and knows that you're going to be patient with them until they figure it out, they will give you their utmost best. They will try their hardest to demonstrate for you because they are in love with the teacher and enfranchised by the fact that you've been civil and patient and ethical with them. Teachers, children from different cultures, teachers facing the challenge of teaching children from different cultures, communities are hard-pressed to decide what constitutes an appropriate curriculum. If children from some groups are hesitant to speak up in school, how can teachers organize excessive language experiences? If children from some groups are dependent on nonverbal cues for meaning, how can teachers stress word meaning? How can teachers test for mastery of the curriculum? How can they do that? Beginning of quote, if children do not speak a standard language or use the same style of communication, cultural diversity makes it hard for teachers to assess each child's development and status. Now, let me change it around. This should not be teacher outcome-based. I don't care how much the teacher has to go to accommodate her pupil. She must make those adjustments and not be an outcome-based for the teacher and the privileges for the teacher. The child's developmental status, find common educational experiences to promote growth, and measure the achievement of educational objectives. Given the complex interaction between culture and development, it is possible to design a developmental appropriate curriculum. If that question implies that the same culture can be used for all children, then you're sadly mistaken, end of quote. You cannot take the same culture and make a cesspool where everyone collapses into Eurocentric thinking. That is the problem we're having in the school districts, even in our suburban schools that are ranked so high. They are hoping that African Americans have no experience, and they're standing on the outside looking in, and they must collapse into Eurocentric thinking. But that cannot happen because we socialize ourselves in a different way when we go back to our communities. We must be able to bring input from our traditional customs and our awareness and our forefathers' Kashmir records. Then we all can grow. You must remember that this is not our first walk in the park. That some of these ancient people, which the indigenous people are, myself and others, we have been here before. We are wise, old substance, and elders who might be going through their third or fourth time here on this earth. But when we're dealing with someone that is a newcomer and that is infantile, that infantile must know their place. And that's why child's play must be identified and must be pointed out that most people can't see their position in this because they're not the ancient ones. They have not been through the earth as many times. But however, in the reading for some of our Caucasian people, they have read about the history of the African. They know the ancient concept and philosophy that they may be reincarnated and coming back through for the fourth or fifth time, meaning that they're elders. So the children must acknowledge this, but it's very vital that you should understand that in the reasoning of a wise old owl, we give homage to animals and we give respect to them because we are all one and connected. But somebody else from a non-African American race, maybe Caucasian, may look at that and say that owl has no place in the human kingdom because it's in the animal kingdom. But we must understand that God created all of us, even the animals, and there's a certain amount of respect that you give those animals and credence. But it's very vital that you should understand your pupil and know about their customs and traditions and beliefs. Because if you don't, you're going to be dumbfounded. Let me go on. And I quote, cultural diversity makes it hard for teachers to assess each child's developmental status. And that's why you have so many failing children. Teachers don't want to deal with hard. They don't want to face the next impossible. So they pass that child on, denying or ignoring the fact that they have not had a breadth of knowledge, only have not had a depth of knowledge, only a breadth, and they pass them on without teaching them. Children sit in their classes for year after year and don't become educated, and that is the fallacy of the whole thing. We cannot continue to pass these children and send them on their way without the proper guidance and teaching. Find common educational experiences to promote growth, given in the complex interaction between culture and development. It is possible to design curriculum, can be used for all children. The answers must be no. However, see, we do not want to design something that's boilerplate that we can give to all children. They even tell you when you put together the IEP, do not make it boilerplate and make it specific to the needs of that individual child. So we must custom create curriculum for individual usage and measure the achievement of educational objectives. Now, begin the quote. Given the complex interaction between cultures and development, it is possible to design a developmentally appropriate curriculum. And I say no. I say we have to have an individual IEP. If that question implies that the same curriculum can be used for all children, the answer must be no, just as I said. However, the following developmental principles can provide a conceptual framework for teachers trying to bridge the gap between children's culture, background, and school objectives, end of quote. Now, let me go on to explain the guideline for teachers. Teachers, some of us get our training in different places, and we must not be in competition with each other when we come into a school, when we find ourselves intimidated by an individual person's previous background of training, because we all have something to give. But we tend to see teachers get in turmoil with other teachers who are outstanding in their display of curriculum writing and carrying out the tasks of that curriculum. It's one thing to write a nice, beautiful lesson plan and cannot carry it out because of so much disruption. Now, I want you to know that disruption comes from a lack of instruction. The more structure you give and give directions and guidance in the class, the less behavior problems you will have. Because once that child is engaged, he doesn't have the time for acting out. Most of you teachers are not engaging these children, and there's too much time and leeway in between the gap. You must teach African Americans rather rapidly. Teach subjects very fast, because that's how their mind travels. If you have drawn out the lesson and have made it so low and slow, the child will lose interest, and you'll lose the child, and he'll go on ahead of you, and he will master that topic. But you can't scold that child and say, now, why did you go and do that? I was guiding you through. When learning and melanin is moving at a speed of a high frequency, you must be able to catch up with that speed and begin to get on the good foot mother or teacher and guide that child through that lesson so they can stay engaged and interested. We have too many children that are falling through the gap that are African-American children that we are also forcing out of the school system to push them out to the point of dropping out. Then why do we have so many children that refuse to learn up under certain teachers? I say we need an overhaul of our teachers, and they need to go back to the drawing board, and not just a trip out to the urban setting to do an internship with maybe 16 weeks with African-American children. I say that if they are not ready to work with those African-American children, go in their own communities and teach. Okay, that's where they're best needed and useful. And allow those African-American teachers who want to teach their own kind to teach their own kind. I spent my first 10 years in all-white schools. Not that I hated it. I had to respect the fact that I was a child. But I gave the best years of my life to a child who had the jaundiced eye when they looked at me and who constantly was worried about my skin tone and the fabric of my hair, till I wonder if they were ever engaged enough to grasp that lesson and go on learning. Because we have too many differences that might get us sidetracked when working with children of different races that are so drastically different. And I say this because African-American children have traveled around the globe trying to get to those better schools to only find out that they were not wanted or accepted. And when you reject a child, it is very hard for them to learn the lesson and get the lesson. And it's very hard for them to go to school every day when they know they're being judged differently. Now, let's go on. And I quote, it says, the second essential not to value some ways of achieving developmental milestones more highly than others. That's where the racism comes in. If you're valuing all of these milestones of Eurocentric thinking, and these have been well thought out and tested procedures, whereas the African-Americans' procedure has not been tested and endorsed, then try it anyway. Because if you're failing that child, then it would help to go with a non-orthodox method in helping that child before you give up on that child and retain the child. That's another thing. We have no business retaining children because they can't read. It is the teacher's fault if the child can't read. We must have line upon line, precept on precept, until they learn to read. You have to have a process. You just can't say, here's the book, now read. You have to come to me and tell me what steps you took to help that young person learn to read. And if you can't tell me the formalities where you build up on word attack skills, decoding skills, and also high-frequency words, because if that child cannot read the syllabic words, then I'm sure he can memorize the high-frequency words. And we have some children that are not even being taught how to read the high-frequency words because at least they can memorize those words. So we got to do a better job and stop blaming the families who send their children with 5,000 less words. It's up to us to put flash words on our ceiling, on our curtains, and on our board, along with the high-frequency words, and build words on a day-to-day basis where we start out giving the child 4 new words every day, and that will build vocabulary. The broader vocabulary you have, the more you can get around things. Building vocabulary is everything. And it's the first thing that our African-American children should be doing in school is mastering language. What can we do for those African-American children that are not mastering language? Why is it so foreign to them? If they're failing it, it must be the second language. Get it? They need to be in our ESL programs and they need to have a differentiated lesson plan, and they need to be taught better so that they can master the king's language. Yes, as African Americans, we have to learn two languages. I speak Ebonics in my community, and I speak Orthodox English when I'm in the presence of my peers and colleagues. So we have to learn double, and we have to master that way of thinking because it's required of us in order to maintain employment. But it's very vital that you should understand that the African-American child should not check out by fourth grade. Statistics are showing that the African male has already checked out and dropped out of school at fourth grade. What do you suppose is happening? I suppose that the curriculum initially was a right brain curriculum, and it switched over to a more logical methodology where African American children were once right brain learners. Now you're switching them to a left brain logical learner. That can jar that child and cause that child to lose interest and drop out physically and mentally. What are we going to do about that? We keep talking about bringing in refugees and immigrants to help correct their socialization problem, and some of them are just getting here. No disrespect, but African Americans were always here. Even Christopher Columbus can tell you they found Africans here on this land. So what are you going to do about giving the African-American child a chance to master the so-called English language? Why have they been ran through the curriculum to the point where they cannot, after being over here centuries, they cannot master the language? What is the problem? Does it need to be taught from their own socialized family members? Does it need to be taught by their own race of people? But we got to do something. We cannot have any more throwaway African-American children and think that it's okay, and then bring in all these Cadillac programs for these immigrants who are coming here on a visitation green card. Now, I say we have got to get that together. You've got to create a place for these African-American children and a way to remediate them without putting them down in the basement, hiding them from other administrators and not including their test scores in, because you are acclimating them before they can come upstairs and you're gradually grafting them in. Now, I know that concept is the same thing with the immigrants and with the actual refugees, where they're kept in sheltered rooms and they're trained and integrated slowly into the mainstream. Now, you cannot leave African Americans out of this. You must include them too. This law and bill was written for minorities, and I think African Americans fit in that category. Then why do we have so many statistics of those children being misdiagnosed who have language barriers and are put in our special ed, LD and BD? That child may not be ignorant, he may not have a learning disability, but you fail to realize that and you sentence that child to a lifelong process of LD who will never be able to be challenged and receive a diploma that indicates that they are equipped to go to college. That is where the tragedy lies, and we've got to do something about it. And we can no longer use the excuse that it's coming from home. We've got to create joint ventures between the home and the teachers. And teachers, you've got to make up in your mind, if it is required for you to do home visits, you must do those home visits. Because if this is a partnership, you must find out if that parent needs tutorial work in the home who might not speak English and need the help in communicating and speaking the language. Now, I said all that to say, let me go on. And it says, African-American children, and I quote, are often judged to be deficient rather than different in their development. Young children who speak languages other than English or who speak non-standard dialect are often reluctant to give up this connection to their group. They are apt to become a confused or disregarded and they're rejected by the school's passage, their rejection of school. Yes, they become rejected, and they become known as a troublemaker, and then they begin to get in trouble with the authorities in the administrative offices, and then they are known as a troublemaker. And before you know it, that child has a Title 20 and is kicked out the school permanently. That has got to stop. The third going on, and the third teachers need to begin instructions with interaction styles and content that is familiar to the children. Whether this entails speaking in the child's primary language using culturally appropriate styles of address or relying on patterns of management familiar to the children. The purpose of this is to establish a basis for communication. Now, we don't want to act like African-American children are creatures and they're aliens, because they know when they've been handled differently and they don't want to appear to be different. We just want you to acknowledge that they have a different way of learning and understand that it's okay for them to bring some of their language from home, okay? Beginning a quote, whether this entails speaking in the child's primary language, using culturally appropriate styles of address, or relying on patterns of management familiar to the children. The purpose is to establish a basis for communication. While fluency in a child's primary language may not be possible for many teachers, they can nonetheless become more in-depth at planning and implementing a culturally sensitive curriculum. What is a culturally sensitive curriculum? You definitely want to leave out those names that are used rather frequently when referring to an African American: porch monkey, lower socioeconomic children. You want to leave out those slangs, because children have caught on to those things, and they know that society has given names to them to avoid from saying the N-word. But it's very vital that we should pick up our arms and realize if we're going to move to the urban setting where black children are, we need to live there too. And we just can't come in there downing what they have faith in and downing their lessons and accomplishment, then that child will have low self-esteem. And that's why I said it's important for African-Americans to teach African-Americans and Caucasians to teach their Caucasian children. What is it? Is it the income? I've known teachers to run to districts just because the actual pay is a lot higher. Not necessarily that they're eager to teach African-American children, because some of them aren't. Just as vice versa, African-Americans are not eager to teach all white children. So what are we saying? Do we need to separate, integrate, or segregate? I say we should have our own schools. African-American children tend to do better when they have a conglomerate of social workers, counselors, teachers, and nurses that look like them. They tend to tell them more. They tend to regularize themselves with that environment easier, and they can flow through the system better. But when they're tipping toes on eggshells and afraid that they're going to do the wrong thing and get suspended, then some things they withhold from the authorities or from those counselors, and they don't discuss them. So the issues don't get dealt with. So I've grown up all my life in all black schools, predominantly, and as I got to high school, maybe one or two non-Melanite people. However, it was easy for me to flow in that environment, and I excelled, and teachers cared about us, and they came to our homes. As a matter of fact, they visited our homes after school, and we sat down and chat and had meals with them. So they were touchable, and they were common to us. Whereas when you go into these suburban settings, these suburban white teachers do not want to integrate with the child, let alone go to their homes. Now, but you say you love children. How is that so when you only want to get back to your suburban areas to affiliate and attach yourself to those who are non-Melanite children. What I have to say is most of our parents want to be connected, and most of the parents want to make changes, but we have such bad press about African-American families, and so many white teachers have dumped on those African-American mothers and told them that the child is failing because of them. Now you got the mother that's African-American beating up on herself, not to mention the distress that she suffers through post-traumatic stress in her community. So we cannot allow teachers to destroy our parents. What we have to do is lift them up where they belong and begin to put hope in them, because we have got to have a sideline view where if you do not know what you're doing when you're teaching African-American children, a specialist needs to be brought in to work with you to make you more sensitive to the African-American's culture. And if you cannot see that way of that child, then you need to exit out of the position, because it's not about money. It's about having a need and need to have respect for a child and the ability to teach that child to read and write fluently without any type of possibilities of the child's customs and traditions influencing it. As I go on and I quote, fourth, the school learning is mostly likely to occur when families value reinforcement, schools, expectations, parents, and other community members must view schools' achievement as a desirable and attainable goal. If children are to build into their senses of self, interpreting the school's agenda for children and for parents is one of the most important tasks for teachers. Fifth, and I quote, when differences exist between the cultural pattern of the home and community and those of the school, teachers must deal with these discrepancies directly. Teachers and children must create shared understanding and new context that gives meaning to. That gives meaning to. Let's see here. Okay. It gives meaning to the knowledge and the skills being taught. Learning mediated by teachers are affectionately and in interest and responsive has greater sticking power than learning mediated by an adult who is perceived as impersonal and distant. Now, we don't want to be distant, do we? And we don't want to be the untouchable, and we don't want to appear aloof and outside of that child's life and not understanding their world. We want to have a glimpse of their world and understand it. And I quote, a developmentally appropriate curriculum can never be standardized in a multicultural community. That is a no-no. Teachers, if I see that you do not know what to do with African-American children and you are trying to take a boilerplate curriculum and make it suitable to fit all children, then I know that you've had inappropriate training and you must indicate that you don't have the experience and the sensitivity to work with African-American children, then maybe you can be placed somewhere else. Okay, and the same thing they told me, because when I went into an all-white school, I was told that all the teachers here all have master's degree, and we could never use you here except for a sub until you get your master's. Now, that's their criteria, and they had every right to tell me that. But guess what? As soon as I went and got that master's degree, I went back to that district, and I said, I'd like to let you know that I am a credential-holding master's degree teacher and a distinguished graduating grad student. And they were very, very pleased. And now you're capable of being hired because they wanted to brag and have bragging rights that all of their instructors and teachers had a master's degree. Nothing wrong with that, okay? But that's not the point. It is, can that teacher deliver information, and can she get her point across to those children? A developmentally appropriate curriculum can never be standardized, as I told you, ladies, in the multicultural community. because the parents are not having it. Once they see you try to use a boilerplate curriculum on their child, they are astute enough to point that out to you. But you must remember that parents of children with differentiated learning and language, they do have a set of rights that you must adhere to, and you must give them the handbook so they'll know. But, and I quote, thoughtful teachers can use principles of children of child development to make the new context of school meaningful and to safeguard the self-confidence of children. This digest was adapted by the Articles of Educating Language Minority Children, Challenge and Opportunity, Challenges and Opportunity, which appeared in the October 1989 issue of PHI Delta Kappa, copyrighted in 1989. For more information, you may contact Carter Margie, Honoring Diversity, Problems and Possibilities of Staff and Organization, Child Care Information Exchange, 59, written in 1988, 43-47. Carter Linda, Linda Carter J, and Nancy Quinsenberry, Early Child, Early Education, and African American History, Assumptions and Implications for the Future, Childhood Education, number 63. Now, if you need to go out and read this, I have done a lot of reading for you. Asa Hillary and Von Scott, Mara Von Scott, and The Quest for the Minority Child in Shirley G. Moore and Catherine Cooper, The Young Child Reviews of Research, Volume 3, Washington, D.C., National Association for Education of Young Children, in 1982. Philip Carroll Bronze, Nurturing Diversity for Today's Children and Tomorrow's Leaders, Young Children, in Volume 43, 1988, 42-47. This publication was prepared with funding from the Office of Educational Research and Improvement, U.S. Department of Education, under OERI contact, and the opinion expressed in the reports do not necessarily reflect the position of policies of OERI or the Department of Education, nor of Omi Inka Sherelle Gard. So, these are views from the beholder. The title, Education Language Minority Children, Documented Type Information Analysis, ERIC Information Analysis Product. Information Analysis ERIC Digest, was selected in its full text, Child Language, Classroom Communication, Cultural Differences, Cultural Influences, Elementary Education, Ethnic Groups, Guidelines, Individual Development, Language of Instruction, Limited English Speaking Minority Groups, Children, Teachers' Responsibility, Teaching Methods, Identifiers, ERIC Digest, Language Minority Students. Thank you so very much for listening to part two of that, teachers, and thank you for sticking around to be a part of this particular digest, because we need to know what we're up against when we're trying to change and overhaul our school. We can no longer go on and perpetuate this nonsense that we have some on the bottom and some on the top. All children can learn. And we must engage all children, regardless of what their cultural background is. And we must give that child the opportunity to heed and succeed. So one of the things that African-American teachers, I'm begging you to do, is to try to brush up your skill in knowing your own customs and tradition so that you can better train the African-American children that you have been responsible for. And for the Caucasian people who are running to the urban setting to get that urban experience, it's going to take more than a one-time shot thing. You're going to have to engage yourself with working with a variety of diversity if that is what your calling is. I do not thrust and push anything upon any teachers who do not wish to be in a setting with all black children, nor do I thrust that upon a black teacher to be in a setting with all white children. We develop and blossom where we are feeling comfortable. So sometimes we can put ourselves in an uncomfortable mood and position and a fearful state. And we should not be pushed into teaching in that type of environment. But I want you to know that you can follow us here on Blog Talk, and you listening to Sherelle M. Garth, and this is the Oracle Divination Network, where you can find educational information for teachers. And we've been talking about our actual affiliate office for the state of Indiana that will be opening here. And we will be having our meetings at the library. So we're going to open up some opportunities to present our services to the school district who might be in need of having a consultant come in to assist them with the assessment and surveying of preschool children. And it's very vital that you should know that this is in demand in Illinois, that all teachers of early childhood that hold a Type 4 certificate go back and get their endorsement in 18 hours of English as a second language. I suggest those here in Indiana would possibly want to do the same thing, because eventually it will be trickling down. Now, there are going to be grade FYs out there with funds for those early childhood grant block grants. So you definitely want to read about them, and we talked about that earlier. You can go and listen to my show on demand on part one. And we came back to you this evening to produce part two. Now, for the next 2 weeks, we'll be on the air on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And those are some pre-recorded sessions that I've done several years ago. We've been on the air now going on 8 years in May. So we have tons of over 600 viewings of our recordings. I think it was 560 or something like that. I can't remember. Of viewings that we can bring back to you. And that's what we're going to do, so that I can get a break and then I can get prepared for our next episodes of what we're going to be covering. I'd like to thank you for going with me on this journey for the drive for our affiliate office, which is the Association of Bicultural, also by Multicultural Education of Indiana. And that is associated with NABE. NABE is the National Association of Bilingual Education. And they will be having their conference in February, and they have a two-for-one special where you bring a friend and you both join together for $55 for the national chapter. And for our chapter, which I just explained to you, is a new affiliate forming chapter. We're now putting our board together and recruiting for members, specifically stakeholders and teachers, early childhood majors. We're going to be doing quite a bit with early childhood, because one of our interest groups will be in early childhood. So we definitely want you to understand that right now our membership is $30, but we are thinking about changing it to $15 per individual, and students could also enroll for $15 as well. So it'll be $15-$15 for those constituents that are students, and for those teachers, $15. And you can join two for one as well. So you need to come on out and join us, and we'll be at one of the local libraries, and we'll give you more information on that. And we'll be doing a wealth of things, looking and examining books, preparing our curriculum, getting a better understanding of the laws and regulation, trying to actually teach us to these laws, just like special ed laws, where you have to have handbooks in order to learn to re-advocate for your children. Parents, you definitely want to get that handbook and learn to advocate for your differentiated learner for English as ELL. So I want to thank you for being a part and going all the way with us. I mean, some of you just went old school on us, and you came all the way up there. Thank you so much, and we're going to go old school on you, and we're going to say old double. We will see you next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Well, folks, so it's time to kick it old school, so you can feel cool. Give it to me, baby. Baby. Yeah.
ladies and gentlemen, I do want you to know that the ECBG full competition, delayed until FY 2019, was sent to me, and I want you to hear what they had to say. Dear early childhood stakeholders, we would like to share the following news from the Illinois State Board of Education's Early Childhood RFP website. Please share this information widely with your community, collaboration, and provider network. And it goes on to read, and I quote, a revised plan from the Early Childhood Block Grant ECBG funding for FY 2018 is being put in place to allow predictability and stability for currently funded grants, while also allowing for program expansion opportunities due to delay in the release of the request for proposals. The full compensation of the ECBG is being delayed until FY 2019, pending final board approval. Currently funded preschool for all PFAs, preschool for all expansion is called, and PFAE and prevention initiative, PIs, and the grantees will receive continuation funding for FY in 2018 and will complete continuation application for FY in 2018. There will be two RFPs, one for PFAE and one for PI, released in May of 2017, that's this year, that will be open to new applicants and continuing programs. Awards for these two RFPs will be based on additional funding doing appropriation to the ECBG. For all full recompetition for FY 2019, there will be three RFPs and preschool all day, preschool for all expansions, and prevention initiatives. The anticipated release date for these RFPs is a fall-winter 2017. Information will continue to be posted on the Early Childhood RFP website. And questions about RFP can be directed to Early Child, CHI, at ISBE.net. So you can contact them, and it says sincerely, OECD. Now, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who are early childhood providers, you definitely want to follow this FY. And this is from ECD. Now, that's the Government of Office of Early Childhood Development. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. And that's something for you to go out and research and follow up on, you stakeholders, administrators, providers, early childhood teachers, and teachers who may be out of work, who are interested in taking up the block grant to provide services to their community at large in the early childhood field. Once again, I'd like to thank you by saying, oh, double, and baba booey to you, y'all. Good evening.